Israel onslaught on the besieged territory continued for the 13th day. According to Palestinian media, about 400 Gazans, including many women and children, were killed in the regime's attacks during the past 24 hours. The strikes targeted homes, residential neighborhoods, and even air raid shelter. Gaza's health ministry says the attacks have claimed the lives of 44 medical personnel while injuring 70 others. In addition, 23 ambulances have also been targeted in defiance of international regulations. Israel began its deadly onslaught on Gaza on October the 7th. Nearly 3,900 Palestinians have died as a result of the regime's strikes, and over 13,500 others have been injured. The Palestinian Journalists Union says 16 journalists have been killed in Israel's attacks. The regime's bombardment of Gaza has also exacerbated the humanitarian situation there, drawing the UN chief's reaction.
Both of my humanitarian appeals are essential in and of themselves. And to help realize these two appeals, I am calling for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. For nearly 2 weeks, the people of Gaza have gone without any shipments of fuel, food, water, medicine, and other essentials. Civilians in Gaza desperately need core services and supplies, and for that we need rapid, unimpeded humanitarian access. We need food, water, medicine, and fuel now. We need it at scale, and we need it to be sustained.
Guterres was speaking in a press conference in the Egyptian capital Cairo as calls mount for aid to reach 2.4 million people in Gaza. Israel has cut off the supply of electricity, water, fuel and medicines into the territory. Egyptian media, however, say the Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt will be opened on Friday to send relief aid into the territory. The World Health Organization has also called for daily aid flow, including fuel, into Gaza.
Fuel is also needed for hospital generators, ambulances, and desalination plants, and we urge Israel to add fuel to the life-saving supplies allowed to enter Gaza. Our trucks are loaded and ready to go. We're working with Egypt and Palestine Red Crescent societies to deliver our supplies into Gaza as soon as the Rafah crossing is opened.
But one of the most critical items which need to be added to that convoy is fuel. Fuel to make sure these desalination plants can run. Fuel to make sure these bakeries can run. Fuel to make sure that UN partners can actually implement the most essential operations. And fuel to ensure these hospitals can sustain their operations and can sustain lives. So fuel is absolutely a top priority.
The recent bombing of Al Ahli Arab Hospital in the Gaza Strip have drawn international condemnations. Press TV has published a feature story highlighting the details and backgrounds of the attack. The latest factual revelations have prompted many countries around the world to blame Israel for the hospital bombing. However, the Israeli regime is still refusing to take responsibility for the carnage, rather shifting the blame on the Gaza-based Islamic Jihad movement. The resistance group has categorically rejected the Israeli claim. The Press TV report highlights similar Israeli shelling, as well as airstrikes on hospitals, healthcare facilities, and even medics over the past days. The report also gives a brief history of Israeli violations of international humanitarian law by targeting civilian infrastructure and medical facilities. Now you can scan the QR code shown on your screen to read the full article. You can also log on to presstv.ir to find this and more similar stories, as well as the latest news, exclusive interviews and articles on the channel's website. Hamas has fired a barrage of rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories as it presses ahead with its retaliation for Israel's relentless bombardment of the fully besieged Gaza Strip. Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, say they have targeted Tel Aviv in response to the regime's war crimes against Palestinians. The resistance group also fired missiles at Ascalon in southern Israel earlier today. At least two missiles have reportedly hit Sderot. Sirens also sounded in northern city of Nahariya for the first time. Meantime, Al-Quds Brigade, the military wing of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, say they have struck an Israeli settlement in the occupied territories. Over 2,000 Israelis have been killed in attacks by the resistance front since October the 7th. Some 4,500 others have also been wounded. The head of the political bureau of the Hamas resistance movement says Israel's crimes against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have revealed the regime's Nazi and fascist nature. Ismail Haniyeh was speaking in a televised speech. He warned that the ongoing Israeli aggression on Gaza could turn into a regional war if the regime's brutal attacks continue. Haniyeh stressed that the way out of the current situation is an end to the Israeli occupation and freedom of the Palestinian people. The senior Hamas official said the world should condemn Israel's crimes and hold their perpetrators accountable at international courts. Haniyeh said the U.S. administration failed to muster international and regional support for the Israeli aggression and make Arab countries accept displacement of Palestinians in Gaza. He called on Muslim nations to hold demonstrations on Friday to demand a halt to Israel's aggression. He also called for more efforts to deliver aid to the people in Gaza, adding that the besieged territory is facing a humanitarian catastrophe due to Israel's Nazi-style brutality. Leila Khaled, the iconic face of the Palestinian cause, she is known as the first woman to lead an airplane hijacking and fighting alongside men for the freedom of a country. Leila says the resistance has existed from the start of the Israeli occupation. Let's take a listen.
No, the Israelis from Myanmar, they occupied Palestine in 19, also after 1967. The resistance was there, died. Even my woman, the women in Palestine, they were not studying. They are putting explosives at the stations, and they were sentenced for life. Of course, every action should use all the tactics to promote the revolution, to be nearer to liberation. So in every era of the struggle, you have tactics and you have the strategy. Mm-hmm. Then in 1987, the Intifada broke out. This is a new stage of our revolution, that the people went to streets to face the army with all its weapons, but our children were facing also the army of Israel. And it took about 6 years. Unfortunately, the leadership of PLO, led by Arafat, went to negotiations. We were against that. But he was supported by the Arabs also to go forward. The negotiations and to sign Oslo Accords afterwards. This now, we ended up with the Intifada, who raised the slogan freedom and independence. And if it went back, and if Arafat and his allies, we could have done that, because the army began to shake, the Israeli army. They are following children. Some of them committed suicide. But it was a historical intifada. Even the word intifada was in all languages intifada. Nobody changed it. And that was also another era of liberation movement.
Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says it has fired guided missiles at an Israeli military base, precisely hitting the desired target. Hezbollah said the strike on Al-Manara base left at least 10 Israeli soldiers injured. Hezbollah also said it hit several Israeli outposts in the northern occupied territories. This as an Israeli drone bombed southern Lebanon. Earlier today, Israel also carried out airstrikes targeting Hezbollah positions. The movement said two of its fighters were killed in clashes with the Israeli military in the region. Southern Lebanon has witnessed exchanges of fire since the 8th of October, a day after a major Palestinian operation against Israel. The recent clashes between Israeli forces and Hezbollah fighters have left over a dozen people dead. Pakistan is witnessing back-to-back rallies denouncing Israeli atrocities in Palestine. Political leaders, human rights activists, and religious scholars have gathered to once again condemn the regime's bloodshed in the besieged Gaza Strip. Nasser Kazmi reports from Islamabad.
From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free!
Anger is boiling in the streets of Pakistan over the United States and Israel. In a fiery expression of outrage, Pakistanis set ablaze the American and Israeli flags, signaling their vehement disapproval of their policies towards the innocent people of Palestine.
Anybody who denies the Holocaust, whether in North America or in Europe, is sent to jail. It is a crime. What Israel is doing is no less than a Holocaust in Palestine.
This is the greatest tragedy that Israeli aggression is being backed by United States and other Western countries. I think that's the time where world should protest against what Israel has been doing over the last 50, 60 years.
Political leaders, human rights activists, and religious scholars united in Islamabad for a series of rallies to condemn Israel's actions in Palestine. They marched in the streets and raised their voices to the world to play its role in stopping Israel from killing innocent men, women, and children in the Gaza Strip on a daily basis.
We are here to protest against the Israelis and anybody who's supporting them right now, be it Muslim leaders or America or anybody. And I would like to tell people that the word is not oppression anymore. The word is genocide. They're literally cleansing Palestine by killing their children specifically.
The rallies were marked by passionate speeches and powerful slogans as the diverse group of attendees came together to demand justice and peace for Palestine.
Unfortunately, the organization of the Islamic country is only condemning the action of the Israel. They are not taking any action. I think that they should announce sanctions against Israel. If they are not in a position to impose sanctions on Israel, they should disband the OIC.
The protesters were also calling for Israel to lift the Gaza blockade and reopen routes for humanitarian aid.
These rallies indicate the growing frustration and anger felt by many over continued violence and the lack of international intervention to protect the lives of thousands of innocent Palestinians besieged by Israeli forces. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Russia has lashed out at the United States for vetoing a UN Security Council resolution that called for a humanitarian pause in the Israeli war on Gaza. The Russian Foreign Ministry said Washington's move will have, quote, monstrous consequences. The ministry accused the U.S. of opposing all humanitarian initiatives since Israel attacked Gaza on October the 7th. It said the conflict between Israel and Gaza reflects the failure of the American policy in the region. Russia also accused Israel of carrying out indiscriminate strikes in Gaza under the pretext of self-defense. It said the right to self-defense does not mean having a license for mass and indiscriminate reprisals. China also slammed the U.S. for obstructing the resolution.
China is deeply disappointed that the United States obstructs the adoption of the draft resolution on the question of Palestine by the Security Council. In the face of escalating tensions, the Security Council should listen to the voices of the vast number of Arab countries and the Palestinian people and earnestly fulfill its responsibilities.
Iran has also condemned the U.S. for vetoing the resolution. On Thursday, President Ebrahim Raisi described the U.S. move as, quote, double oppression of Palestinians, saying Washington and Tel Aviv are committing genocide and crimes against humanity in Gaza. The Brazil-sponsored draft resolution was put to the vote during a Security Council session on Wednesday. It called for humanitarian corridors into Gaza. The resolution was backed by 12 countries, but the U.S., which is a permanent member of the council, vetoed it. A military base in western Iraq that hosts U.S. troops has been struck once more by a salvo of missiles and drones. According to local sources, multiple explosions rocked the Ain al-Assad airbase in the Al-Anbar province. The Iraqi military closed the area and started a search operation. There have been no reports of possible casualties and damages yet. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq has claimed responsibility for the attack, saying its missiles hit the American base with precision. This was the third attack in less than 24 hours against U.S. bases in Iraq and the neighboring Syria. Last week, Iraqi resistance groups threatened to target U.S. interests if Washington intervened to support Israel's ongoing attacks on Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The U.S. maintains some 2,500 troops in Iraq and 900 more in Syria under the pretext of fighting terrorism. The United Nations has officially declared the termination of all restrictions imposed on Iran's ballistic missile-related activities and restrictions on the export and import of missile items to Iran. The restrictions were imposed under the provisions of the Security Council Resolution 2231. The Security Council Secretariat confirmed the termination of the provisions in a note to the member states and also in a separate letter to Iran's permanent ambassador to the UN. The provisions were set to expire automatically after 8 years, which fell on October 18, 2023. The curbs affected Iran's missile tests, export and import of missile items, and provision of financial services to Iranian individuals and institutions. Despite the expiration of the UN bans, the United States has announced fresh anti-Iran sanctions, vowing to maintain restrictions on the country's ballistic missile and drone programs. The European Council has followed suit, saying it will take necessary steps to maintain the restrictive measures against Tehran. Iran has denounced the decisions as unilateral and politically unjustifiable, saying they violate the UN Charter. That's it for this hour's bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The Zionist regime fire has killed many Palestinian children during the same period that was conducting genocidal campaign against the children in Gaza. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, tens of Palestinian children have been killed in the occupied West Bank since the Zionist regime's genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip started on October 7th. Defense for Children International, Palestine, has been conducting field investigations of each case. Palestinians in the West Bank have been holding demonstrations all week to protest the Zionist regime's war against Gaza and show solidarity with the population of 2.3 million there. The Zionist regime fire killed tens of Palestinians there during the same period, according to the Palestinian Authority's health ministry. It is within the context of these demonstrations that the Zionist regime is targeting Palestinians. The Israeli occupation troops shot and killed Karam Ayman Dwekat, a 17-year-old boy, in Beit Tah village. Israeli regime occupation troops shot and killed Karam Ayman Dwekat, a 17-year-old boy, in Beit Tah village, south of Nablus city, recently. An Israeli regime troop shot Karam from a distance of 30 to 50 meters as the Zionist regime forces protected and accompanied settlers invading the Jabal al-Arma area, where settlers have also repeatedly attempted to establish an outpost. Karam was with other Palestinian youths who arrived to confront settlers and troops invading their land and attempting to intimidate Palestinians there. DCIP said, footage depicting the moment Israeli forces shot Karam suggests that he did not present any threat to life or serious injury when he was targeted by Israeli forces. The Zionist regime forces fired intensively and indiscriminately at Palestinians demonstrating in solidarity with Gaza in Beit Furair, east of Nablus, on October 13. An Israeli regime bullet struck 13-year-old Amir Rafat Melaitat in the head, killing him. He was 150 meters away. The Zionist regime forces shot a 17-year-old boy in the head and chest in the occupied East Al-Quds of the neighborhood of Isawiya on October 13th, killing him. Muhammad Taher Ali Mustafa was standing less than 100 meters from members of the Israeli regime border police, a paramilitary force, during confrontations when they shot him. In the same neighborhood, another 17-year-old boy was found with a gunshot wound in his chest. Lays Othame Abu Mara had spoken to his father on the phone and indicated he was with friends near the entrance of Isawiya. The boy was found wounded half an hour later and transferred to hospital. An Israeli regime sniper luckily shot Lays from a distance of 50 to 100 meters, doctors told DCIP. DCIP said Muhammad Taher Ali Mustafa's funeral had just finished when Lays's death was announced. Another boy was found dead in the same evening with a gunshot wound to the back of his head in Beit Liria village near Ramallah, the seat of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Hussein Mu'taz Musa, 16, participated in a march protesting the Zionist regime's war on Gaza with youth in the village following Friday prayers. Palestinian youth allegedly threw stones toward the troops. DCIP said Hussein did not come home after the demonstration and his family was told that he was left alone. His parents discovered his body after hours of searching. The Zionist occupation forces shot a 17-year-old boy in the head in Al-Ram, a town just east of Al-Quds, on the same evening. Ayham Iyad Jabarin was 150 meters away from Israeli regime forces when they shot him. There had been a demonstration at Aram, where Palestinian residents set fires near the entrance of the town in a confrontation with Israeli regime occupation forces. The next day, Zionist troops fired live ammunition throughout the afternoon and evening at Palestinians in the city of Tul Karm, demonstrating in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. Palestinians were confronting the Zionist regime troops at a checkpoint near the Zionist regime's apartheid wall in the West Bank. Rafat Taher Abu Manha was sitting in the passenger seat in a car near the checkpoint when the Zionist regime forces opened fire at the car from 150 meters away. According to DCIP, an Israeli bullet struck the 17-year-old boy in the head, expelling brain matter. The Zionist regime troops shot him in the back as well. He was pronounced dead on arrival at a hospital in the city. Three others in the car were injured and transferred to the hospital as well. On the afternoon of October 13th, Israeli regime forces shot 14-year-old Omar Ahmad Asmar in Zeita near Tul Karm in the northern West Bank. Omar was participating in a march heading towards the Israeli apartheid wall. Israeli regime forces opened fire from a distance of 100 meters away, striking him in the thigh. He was hospitalized and pronounced dead the next day. A 16-year-old boy that Israeli occupation forces shot on October 10th succumbed to his wounds on October 14th. Mohammad Rafat Edwan had been at a demonstration in Farun near Tul Karm in northern West Bank, where youth were approaching the Zionist regime's apartheid wall and throwing rocks at Israeli regime troops there. Israeli regime forces opened fire at Mohammad from a distance of 150 to 200 meters, shooting him in the right shoulder. The bullet had caused severe bleeding in his lung, where it settled, and bullet fragments had penetrated his spinal cord in his neck, causing him to become paralyzed from the neck down. Doctors were unable to stop the bleeding, and he was pronounced dead on October 14th. Ayed Abu Ertiash, DCIP's accountability program director, said Israeli forces know no bounds and are empowered to shoot to kill Palestinians, including children, and now, as a matter of routine, unlawfully shoot and kill Palestinian children. He said Israeli forces and settlers are emboldened by systematic impunity and international support to commit war crimes on a whim. In the Gaza Strip, more than 700 Palestinian children have been killed in the Zionist regime strikes since October 7th. That is an average of 100 Palestinian children per day. Meanwhile, Middle East Eye wrote about the survived children in Gaza. The children feel bored and restless. They want to play and live their childhood despite the anxiety and tension surrounding them. But the conditions don't allow it. Most of the time, the children complain, cry, and bother their mothers. They also want things like juice, chocolate, crisps, and sweets. But nothing like that is available in the local stores in the Gaza Strip anymore. They are completely empty. And not just that, most children in Gaza Strip have fallen ill, not helped by clouds of dust, dirt, and smoke rising from the Zionist regime bombings against Gaza.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear ladies from all around the world. Welcome back to a new episode of your own program, Muslim Lady. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Asma. I have the honor to be your host once more. And here we have Sister Zainab with us. Assalamu alaikum, sister. And
welcome. Assalam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Well, as a rule in our Islamic heritage and narrations, we have it that men and women should not be kept in the same place all alone. I mean, one woman and one man coming together, sitting in the room, just all alone. The third person is going to be the devil. So we have this in our religion. And considering this, there comes the rule of society in which there is segregation and separation of men and women from each other. As in, for example, there are some special hospitals for women, or actually that's for the benefit of women, for them to be all free in that department, in that building, so they can take all the freedom they want to have. And then also at a school, the school of girls is separated from the school of boys. And then at university also, there are some universities out there that segregate boys and girls from each other. Now there comes this question from the other people who do not know much about the nature of men and women or about the truth behind the narrations of Islam. There comes this question that, is segregation meant to be a tool for freedom or no? It is meant to take the freedom from you. Is it a contradiction to independence?
Definitely not, because you have already answered that. What we have in religion is that if these two opposite genders are alone at a particular place, the third person is definitely shaitan. So based on this principle, we have segregation in the Islamic societies and in many societies, like, you know, but the subject has raised numerous questions, or I would say even eyebrows,
yeah,
in various parts of the world, like, you know, this is not independence, this is against humanity and freedom
and human rights, right, whatsoever.
Why do even some countries have separate train carriages for women? Why are schools often segregated by gender? Why are there many houses in the Islamic societies where there's a separate place for women when guests come?
Exactly.
Or, you know, why are mosques separated by the curtains? I would be going through all of them one by one, you know. Mm-hmm. These questions may seem perplexing at the first glance, but the underlying reasons, as you also mentioned, are rooted in a profound respect for women to ensure their safety, dignity, and also comfort.
Yeah, comfort, that's very important.
I would actually say until and unless you have not traveled in both the trains, which is like in a mess together and in a segregated compartments, if you don't have both experiences, you can't actually comment.
Understand the word comfort.
Exactly. You can't comment on them. I personally, unfortunately, have come from a society wherein we had no concept of
segregation
in schools.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I have grown up in co-education, but I remember we every day had issues. Every day we had some cases going to the principal.
Dramas.
Yeah, going to the principal office and, you know, cases of abuse in very young age. Like, I think I had, we had school only up to 16, and then we had colleges, we had universities. But since our schools were not segregated, we had issues since our schools.
Yeah.
And then I came to Jamia Tazara University in Qom, and for the first time in my life, I actually experienced
what comfort means.
Woman-only institute. And then what the media says, that when you're together, when you're in co-ed, that's freedom. I experienced what is freedom there, living with, you know, studying with women, your lecturer is a woman, everyone around is a woman. Like, I was so, so comfortable. I felt like this is the comfort zone. We are being, you know, fed the lies.
Exactly. So media. Didn't you feel that you're more focused on the concepts that you're studying?
Right. Like, not only focused, you're like free, you know.
Yeah.
In real sense, you're free. You don't have any fear that somebody is looking at me with this or that,
yeah,
intention.
Some unessential things that would take your brain.
Exactly.
Why? If you just take it away, then all the problem is solved.
Exactly. So, you know, and I have traveled in both the trains. I wouldn't say trains. I would say in India, I have traveled in a bus, which was a mixed-up bus,
yeah.
Both men and women. And here in Iran, I traveled in a train, which was segregated again by gender.
Exactly.
And seriously, I'm telling you, until and unless you don't experience both things, you can't comment.
You can't differentiate.
Exactly.
So, yes, segregation is meant to be for the benefit of women, is meant to make them feel more comfort as they do their work, as they study, as they go to university, as they go to their job departments or whatever. Yeah, let's go for a short break and then we'll be back. Thank you for staying with us. Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Sister Zainab and I were talking about segregation of men and women, the separation of departments, of buildings that men and women would experience through their education or their working time or etc. So
let's address to the practice of having separate train compartments for women and men. It's not only the Islamic countries. You could also see this practice in Korea. And
exactly. I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah. And recently, a reporter was saying, he was asked why you are having the separate, segregation of men and women. And he was like, we're not like you. We don't want our women to get harassed. We don't want our women to get exposed to abusive behavior.
Exactly.
So, you know, even the non-Muslim societies understand this. The introduction of women-only carriages was primarily aimed at ensuring safety and well-being of women in their daily commutes. You know, it's not because the harassment, the uncomfortable experiences for women are becoming so common on public transportation. I know that being coming from that society wherein we had public transportation where both genders were mixed up, you can't even travel. You can, like, I plan to buy my own personal vehicle rather than traveling in the public transportation.
Exactly.
Which was mixed. And it took me a lot because not everyone around can buy a private transport.
Can afford that, yeah.
Yeah, it's actually the responsibility of the society to create a segregated compartment so that women can feel, you know, comfortable. They don't have those
and
uncomfortable,
you know,
experiences.
It's the matter of humanity. Even if we forget about religion, it's the matter of humanity. There is a woman and there is a man. If you put them together, there might be too much of dramas and problems. So she wants to study. She wants to fulfill her dreams. She wants to be someone for herself. But then the outside world, as we said, is a dangerous place. And there are some people who do not understand the dreams of this delicate creature. So she must be protected.
Right. Actually, you are providing her a safer environment by segregating.
Exactly.
You are providing her
with peace of mind, with comfort.
That comfort that you are reducing the risk of a harassment.
Exactly.
You are actually taking a proactive measure to protect her and ensure that she feels secure while using public transportation when it comes to trains. So now, when it comes to segregation of schools by gender, it's often misunderstood again because it's not about prioritizing one gender over the other. Most of the times it's thought so, or I would say media says so, but I explained my personal experience as well here. It's often motivated by cultural and religious considerations, mm-hmm. like you said in the beginning of the episode. Some communities believe that separating boys and girls in schools can help maintain modesty. And I have seen that because I personally have grown up in a co-ed and my son is studying in a gender-segregated school. I could see the level of modesty he possesses and the level of modesty the children in our cultures possess those who are studying in the co-ed. So, you know, you are basically creating a more comfortable learning environment when you are doing that in the schools.
Sister Zainab, I'm sorry for interrupting you. Just I wanted to add some points, some personal experience. Well, we have some friends, and then when they come to our home, you know, ever since we were children, they have children, and there are boys, there are girls. So when they came to our home, we had two different rooms, one for women and the other for men. We felt that comfort, you know, at the gatherings of women. They feel so comfortable together because they can wear as free as they wish. They can be so comfortable in their choice of dress. And also, the men on the other side would be having their own gatherings, you know, because there are some special topics that is interested for them, that is a matter of interest for them. And also, in this room of women, they could have their own topics. So this segregation is not going to mean as, okay, you are taking them from each other. You do not let men see women or women see men. It's not just like that.
I like this concept over here. I saw this getting practiced here in the majalis, like women majalis. They can only take female daughters with them when they, yeah, they reach that particular age. And they don't take the male sons with them. Male sons go
with their fathers.
With their fathers. This is such a beautiful concept, you know. You are creating a conductive atmosphere for learning, be that at schools, be that at majalis, because ultimately you're going to learn something over there.
So, and the members are going to be more attentive.
Right. You're going,
because there's no distraction.
You're preserving those cultural values. You're preserving those religious values when you allow such things to happen. So talking about having a separate room in the Islamic societies between men and women, it is also, again, a very beautiful concept. I would shed light on that if we
want to go after the break, I suppose. So, dear ladies, let's go for a short break and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. This is the last part of today's episode. Let's wrap it all up.
Luckily, my husband was from an Iranian culture and I was from the Asian culture. And there we have a mix-up of men and women. And when they sent someone for looking for a girl, their criteria was that there should be modesty in the family. There should be segregation. And some person called them and told them, I have seen segregation only in one home, and that was ours. And what kind of segregation was it? We didn't have this concept, but our father would never allow us to get tea for the guests. He would tell us to call me on my phone and put it on the door, and I'll get it in myself. You don't come in and in front
bother
of the guests.
Yourself.
Yeah. So that he did a kind of segregation without us making us understand that
exactly.
We are segregated. But maintaining that modesty, maintaining that chastity. I today understand how
exactly.
much independence we felt. I today understand we didn't become the victims of, like, anyone can look at us.
How
and
much
you
cared
never know.
For your dignity and for your character.
We never know who is looking at you with what intention.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, that was the modesty that our father helped us with.
So this was a nice example. And as I told you, we have it in our culture. And this segregation does not mean that you do not have any independence or it's the opposite of your freedom. No, on the contrary, it would just provide you with more of comfort and actually peace of mind. Thank you for staying with us. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges, nothing in life is free. Mm-hmm.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Australians have overwhelmingly rejected a proposal to recognise Aboriginal people in the country's constitution and create a body to advise Parliament on Indigenous issues. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Independent has covered this story. Australia on Saturday, 14th of October, overwhelmingly rejected a proposal to recognise Indigenous people in the Constitution, in a major setback for the country's efforts for reconciliation with its First Peoples. The referendum decides whether to tackle the disadvantages faced by Indigenous people in the country by enshrining a new advocacy committee in the Constitution. Australians are required to vote either yes or no to whether they agree to alter the country's 122-years-old constitution to create an Indigenous body called the Voice to Parliament, which would provide advice to the government on Indigenous issues. In all but one state, polling closed on Saturday, 14th of October, with the no vote dominating early counting. An early vote count suggests the states of New South Wales and Tasmania would reject the change of the constitution. This means creating the Indigenous body would need majorities in each of the four remaining states, as well as a national majority. Advocates for the constitutional change have already conceded defeat in the referendum to create Indigenous Voice to Parliament, according to an Associated Press report. Indigenous Australians, who make up around 3.8% of the country's population, constitute the nation's most disadvantaged ethnic minority. Reports have shown that they die 8 years younger on average than the wider population and suffer from diseases that have been eradicated from many wealthy countries. A majority supported The Voice earlier this year, but the No campaign gathered momentum over time. Of the nearly 18 million Australians enrolled to vote in the referendum, around 6 million have cast their ballots in early voting over the last 3 weeks. The Yes campaign winning a majority would make life better for Indigenous peoples, Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said. He added, "No takes us nowhere. We're living in no right now. Kindness costs nothing." While many Indigenous people favour the change, some fear it could be a distraction from achieving practical outcomes. Major Conservative parties are also campaigning for a no vote, saying the measure is divisive and would be ineffective. Opinion polls conducted in the months leading to the referendum suggest a strong majority of Australians oppose the proposal. Early counting of about 11% of the votes found that the No campaign led the Yes campaign by 55.4% to 44.6%. The Al Jazeera television network has also covered this story and tells us more. Australians have resoundingly rejected a proposed reform to the country's constitution that would recognise Indigenous people, a referendum's results have shown. With most of the votes counted on Saturday, 14th of October, it has become clear that the yes vote has failed to reach the required threshold, with the goal of creating an Indigenous advisory body called the Indigenous Voice to Parliament. Those opposed to the reforms led those in favour 60% to 40%, with all but one of the six states that needed to also be in favour actually voting to reject the proposal. The highest number of yes votes were registered in Victoria with 46%, with Queensland seeing the lowest at 32%. However, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese defended his decision to push for a referendum and said, "We must seek a new way forward with the same optimism. Tonight is not the end of the road and is certainly not the end of our efforts to bring people together," Albanese said. The Indigenous citizens in Australia make up about 3.8% of the country's population of 26 million and have inhabited the land for some 65,000 years. But they are not mentioned in the country's constitution and remain disadvantaged in a range of areas, including healthcare and housing. Supporters of the proposal to make changes to the country's 122-years-old constitution believe adding an Indigenous voice to the document would help reconcile the country, but opponents have called it divisive and ineffective. From the 44 referendums that have been held in Australia since its founding in 1901, only 8 have successfully passed. This is the first referendum in Australia since voters rejected a proposal to become a republic almost a quarter of a century ago. The vote on Saturday, 14th of October, may also have implications for misinformation in Australia, as a large campaign had spread through social media sites prior to the vote that sparked fears that the Indigenous Voice to Parliament, a purely advisory body, would become a third chamber of Australia's Parliament and bring Aboriginal people more federal funding. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese also touched on this and criticised sections of the media that he said had steered the referendum debate away from the core issues. "We have had, including in outlets represented in this room, discussions about a range of things that were nothing to do with what was on the ballot paper tonight," Prime Minister Albanese told reporters on Saturday. The Daily Beast has also covered the same story. Australians have overwhelmingly rejected a proposal to recognise Aboriginal people in the country's constitution and create a body to advise Parliament on Indigenous issues. Saturday's Voice to Parliament referendum failed, with the Associated Press reporting that more than 59% of voters opposed the move and almost half the votes were counted. The loss is unofficial but is not contested. The Yes campaign needed to secure both a majority of the national vote as well as majorities in 4 of Australia's 6 states. The vote comes 235 years after British settlement of Australia, 61 years after Aboriginal Australians were given the right to vote, and 15 years since the then Prime Minister Kevin Rudd apologised for past Australian governments forcibly removing Aboriginal children from Indigenous families. The British newspaper The Observer has also covered the same story. Australians have resoundingly rejected a proposal to recognise Aboriginal people in the country's constitution and establish a body to advise Parliament on Indigenous issues. Saturday, 14th of October's Voice to Parliament referendum failed, with a defeat clear just shortly after polls closed. to succeed the Yes campaign, advocating for the voice needed to secure a double majority, meaning it needed both a majority of the national vote as well as majorities in four of Australia's six states. The defeat will be seen by Indigenous advocates in Australia as a blow to what has been a hard-fought struggle to progress reconciliation and recognition in modern Australia, with First Nation people continuing to suffer discrimination, poorer health and economic outcomes. More than 17 million Australians were enrolled for the compulsory vote, with many expatriates visiting embassies around the world in the weeks leading up to Saturday's poll. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese called for Australians to show kindness to each other after the referendum. "This moment of disagreement does not define us and it will not divide us," Anthony Albanese said. He added, "We're not yes voters or no voters, we're all Australians. And it is as Australians together that we must take our country beyond this debate without forgetting why we had it in the first place."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel's genocidal attacks on Palestinian homes and infrastructure continue across the besieged Gaza Strip, killing more people, especially women and children. The Hamas leader says Israel's crimes in the Gaza Strip reveal the regime's Nazi and fascist nature, warning of a regional war if the regime's aggression continues. A Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says it has hit an Israeli military base with guided missiles in a retaliatory operation. Thank you for joining us. More Palestinians have lost their lives in the Gaza Strip as the Israeli regime's genocidal onslaught on the besieged territory continued for the 13th day. According to Palestinian media,